Our world has become complex and disruptive, and leading teams and organizations takes courage, determination, and skill. This podcast connects you to some of the great leaders to find out just how they do it. You're listening to Russell Boyce and Daryl Crook in conversation with standout leadership in a world of disruption.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this very first edition of Leadership in a World of Disruption. Today, we've got a really special standout leader joining us, but let's kick off with a word or two of introductions from Daryl and myself. I'm Russell Boyce. For over three decades, I've been building and leading teams in high technology disruption. For example, hypersonic rocket-launched scramjet flight experiments and developing and flying advanced satellite systems with onboard artificial intelligence. However, throughout my career, I've learnt that the science and technology is dead easy in comparison with the challenges of leadership. It's those leadership challenges and becoming the best leader that I can be and passing any skills that I develop onto the younger generations that really gets me excited. I'm privileged to be able to do that with senior leaders via the INSEAD Advanced Management Program, with my professional colleagues, and also with STEM-focused school teachers. I'm really looking forward to what each conversation in our podcast might offer to current and future leaders across the world.
And I'm Daryl Crook. Nice to meet you all out there in listener land. I've had the last 35 years working as a management consultant, a consultant psych, an executive coach, working all over the world with top 100 companies. And in my spare time, teaching MBA classes and Master of Public Health classes at varying universities. Most of the work that I've been doing is around strategy, governance, leadership, dealing with C-suite and boards. And to be able to put these podcasts together where we can get insights from leaders across a number of sectors and to be able to ask them questions around their leadership style, questions around how they're dealing with disruption and the disruption of many sorts that's going on in the world today. So with that, let's go to our first person.
To help us start this podcast journey, allow me to introduce you to the Honourable Greg Hunt. Greg's a keen family man, an enthusiastic long-distance runner, a lawyer, a former Fulbright scholar with a master's from Yale, is scarily talented at debating, and served the people of Australia as Minister for the Environment, Minister for Industry, Innovation and Science, and most recently the Federal Minister for Health as the COVID pandemic hit and unfolded. Greg, I can't imagine somebody more qualified than you to talk with us about leadership in the face of disruption. It's a pleasure to have you.
Well, look, thanks very much to Russell and to Daryl. But I was privileged to be in the role when we had extraordinary people in government, in the department, and then in the health and medical profession. And I think if there was one lesson, it was drawing on all of those skills and trying to establish a national outcome, the what we wanted to achieve, or you might remember it as flattening the curve, which simply meant bringing the number of cases and therefore the number of those requiring ventilation below the capacity whilst lifting the capacity. And that was all about saving lives and protecting lives. So it was a unifying message, but drawing upon the incredible national talent. And my take from all of this, we can sometimes be, in our laconic Australian way, critical of who we are and what we are. But I think we are a better country than we ever imagined, and certainly than we let on to ourselves. And the fact that the New York Times, when the US passed a million lives lost only a few months ago in May, featured the US and compared it with one country in the world for their pandemic management, and that country was Australia, as to how to get things right, I think that speaks to the fact that there's a lot of good leadership in a lot of places right around the country.
Greg, I don't know that our listeners, and our listeners are global, and it's, I think your last comment there about the UK is very fitting. As they're tuning into this podcast from everywhere, they're, they're really trying to get their head around leadership. Some of our listeners are young up and coming leaders. Some of them are probably middle managers and aspiring to senior leadership. And some of our listeners are very senior executives through to chairmen of board. And to be able to get insights into the true art of leadership, in a sense, can I start by asking you your thoughts? A fine gentleman by the name of Sir Adrian Cadbury, who was a pioneer in stimulating debate in corporate governance worldwide, based out of the UK. One of his very memorable comments was he spoke of the moral superiority of the uninvolved. And he talked about, you know, it's very easy to sit back and throw rocks and to criticize and so forth, because you're actually not there. You're not in it. You're not part of it. And as I think about that wonderful quote, the moral superiority of the uninvolved, I think about, you know, the role that you had there, where you are influencing without absolute authority, where you are taking on one of the toughest leadership roles out there, and knowing that there will be people with completely different views of the world. Tell us two things, Greg. How you managed that style of leadership, and as a follow-up, the toll it takes when you are leading through a crisis, and I'll come to that a little bit later. But the first question, how do you manage when you are leading without absolute authority, knowing darn well that there's a lot of folks out there with differing views?
Sure. So the first thing is, actually, I'll begin with a story. So I'm speaking to you from Mount Martha in Victoria in Australia. And so it's the study where I, for good parts of the pandemic, was based, and for other parts I was in long stretches in Canberra. There's an estuary nearby called Balcombe Estuary, and the locals are used to seeing me. This is where I grew up in the area, and I've lived here in the parliamentary role, which I've now finished, for 20 years. And so that's just Greg. Nobody gets too fast. This was the 21st of March 2020. Italy, France, Spain were facing collapse. People were passing in the streets in New York and being buried in open, unmarked graves in Roosevelt Island. It was a level of fear the likes of which we'd not seen. And I remember standing next to Balcombe Estuary doing a press conference, and there were six cameras there, all the TV channels plus Sky, and the locals started to gather around. They were out walking, but they distanced naturally, a little bit like the fan that you see with the Wi-Fi symbol. And they were in layers and distanced apart from each other, and they were just completely focused. And the thing that struck me then is that people were looking for two outcomes. One is they wanted real hope. They wanted honesty, but a sense that we would get through this. And then the second is they wanted to understand how. And those were always the principles that myself and the Prime Minister, the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, and Brendan Murphy, the incredible Chief Medical Officer who became the Secretary, and his successor, Professor Paul Kelly, they were the principles we adopted of giving people genuine answers, but with hope, always explaining that we'll get through this, and doing it calmly, and doing it in a way which also explained the how, what we're doing, and then what people could do. And that was as motivating a peacetime task as anybody could have. And so we always viewed this in terms of our work coupled with the work of the medical fraternity and the community was going to be the difference between what was occurring already overseas in, you know, great comparable countries of the UK and the US and France and Italy and Spain, and just the massive human tragedy that was occurring there, which was visible in real time to us, and the alternative of not having that. And in 2020, we were one of the few countries in the world to have what's called a negative excess death rate. Fewer deaths than you would have expected in an ordinary year that wasn't a pandemic year. And there's Australia and a handful of others. And that was immensely motivating. So what was our messaging? Was the sense of realistic hope, talking about the pluses and minuses, but to give people that sense, and then the plan, and then enacting the plan, which was about containment, slowing the spread, and capacity, building the ability of the primary health care, the aged care, and the hospital system to withstand, and the research community to adapt and respond with treatments and vaccines. And so that was how we approached it. And, you know, yes, it was challenging. But you asked what would sustain you in that situation? Two things. One is the purpose, knowing that you will never be involved in more significant, more important work, I hope. And then secondly, the things that matter to me, my sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs for Greg is exercise over sleep and sleep over food. It's sort of an inverted pyramid for some, but my staff would always make sure, no matter what, we've got to carve out his exercise. Doesn't need a whole heap of sleep, but he needs the exercise. And then the second element of the personal is to speak to the family if I was distant from them. That's what got me through.
Thanks, Greg. You know, I'm sitting here and I have a strong commitment and passion around leadership, working with executives, and we constantly are talking about, you know, you're no good to anybody if you're horizontal. You know, look after yourself and manage your own resilience and your own health. And you've just underlined that very much so. I also enjoyed your very pragmatic view of saying, here is the reality, and here is what we're going to do, and here's what you need to do, and giving people that hope, not false hope, not artificial Pollyanna hope, but genuineness and authenticity in that leadership style. So thank you for that. That was a great way to start, and I really appreciate some of those key elements of leadership coming through already.
Pleasure. And Greg, you mentioned, in fact, you elaborated quite a bit on execution. You recognised that Australia and the world were in crisis. Failure was not an option. Things just had to get done, and the what and the how were very important. There's a challenge, though. It's probably harder to do that in the public leadership role than in the private. If you're in a private company, you can just say, this is our strategy, pull the trigger, and away you go. And if you get it wrong, the company dies. But at least you can move fast. In the public sector, it's not quite like that. There's a lot of voices, government departments, bureaucracies naturally move quite slowly, and yet you were in a crisis situation. So how did you deal with that? How did you get that execution happening? And that's a leadership question, both as the minister leader, but also how did you get that happening in your own personal team?
So let me break this up into a couple of things. As a government and then as health minister, as a government, we were fortunate in that there was a very strong personal relationship between the then Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, and myself. Josh and I predate our parliamentary careers. We're in fact long-term friends over a quarter century, and godparents to each other's daughters. So we're really close, and he was my best man. And we had a very clear alignment of purpose and defined the mission. You know, a lot of credit goes to the Prime Minister, and there was a real unity of purpose around this notion of getting ahead of it and staying ahead of it. I remember on the 21st of January 2020, when this disease was barely heard of, but Brendan Murphy was outlining the fact that, you know, in seismic terms, this was the big one. And we don't know for certain, but it has that potential. And, you know, Pam and I agreed we'll get ahead of it, we'll stay ahead of it, and we'll just keep running. And sometimes we'll take decisions which we might look back on and say, gee, was that too much? But what we didn't want to do was to undercook Australia's response. And so from that, we used the instruments of government, the cabinet, the budget committee, and in particular, the National Security Committee of Cabinet, which is a subsection, but it brings in senior officials. And so all of those things came together. What we were able to do was that was meeting in one way, shape or form virtually every day early on. And we were having departmental meetings every day. So we had that coordinating mechanism and that defined purpose of flattening the curve or building our containment around the four pillars of borders, testing, tracing, and distancing. So, and then building the capacity around the primary care, the aged care, the hospitals and the ventilator capacity and the research. And then we executed inside each one of those, in particular, early on, with my department, we had, you know, an amazing secretary, first Glenys Beauchamp and then secondly Carolyn Edwards. Glenys stayed on. She was going to retire, but, you know, we convinced her to stay on, and then we handed over to Carolyn Edwards. Brendan Murphy as the chief medical officer, who was going to become secretary but agreed to stay on as chief medical officer. And that same government alignment we built within the department, and each day we would look to the meta strategy and then the micro requirements. And we established procurement teams. We established a second procurement team to oversee it. We brought in the whole of government and we moved quickly. And we also designed policy around that and put all those things in place. So alignment of purpose and then a daily executive process of ensuring there was implementation. All of that was under the broader rubric of the communication and the messaging.
So you were able to do a lot of that with positional power, with you were the minister, but there must have been a strong element of soft power, of personal attributes, of emotional intelligence. You were in the thick of it with your peers, with subordinates, with direct reports. What did that look like, the soft, the personal?
So the first thing is, you know, the weakness would have been probably up to 1,000 messages coming in a day on the phone. I hated my phone. And the rest of it, you know, I understood, but that time pressure was enormous. But beyond that, what I found is just talking to people about their role and how important it was, and they'll never do more important work, and giving them the sense of purpose, but then the direction. Those two things, purpose and direction, and giving them autonomy to do it. And so we put in place protections for individuals and a backup to overview it, but with a message, move, 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 take decisions. If in doubt, come to me and I will take decisions. If it's beyond my remit, and I would often just make the decisions and take responsibility, then I'll refer it to the cabinet process. But that was what we did internally. Externally was much harder because it was a contested political process. You had an opposition, which I think sought to try to contest anything it could contest. But we built the national cabinet to bring on board the states and to bring on board the medical advice. In the early days, there were contested views from states and medical advice. But the national cabinet process, which was informed by the collapse of federal cooperation during the Spanish flu 100 years ago, was something that was brought together to provide a single unified pathway to try to cut through differing medical competition and voices, and then to cut through different political voices. And that did actually provide a vehicle, contested and challenged, but nevertheless it held the states in a common process with the Australian government and had learnt from the near collapse of Federation 100 years ago.
Greg, you used the word purpose several times there. Often when I'm dealing with leaders, not necessarily only in the corporate world, but I'm dealing with leaders in not-for-profits and the several state government authorities I talk to. And you know, when I talk about the importance of purpose as a leader, I will often get some rather shallow answers back. Their purpose is to make money, or their purpose is to do as they're told. And that clearly to me says that, unfortunately, those leaders don't understand. Purpose, we know, deeply drives people if it is real to them. How did you make their purpose real to them?
Well, we could literally define it. Let's think of the containment example. Obviously, the borders, that was more of legal decision-making where we were able to make those decisions. The Departments of Home Affairs and the Border Force, Australian Border Force, were able to implement them. But overnight, they were able to do it. But then on something such as, my greatest fear for quite a while is that we would not have adequate flow of testing kits, because testing allowed us to identify the cases and therefore to trace them and therefore to stop the spread. And we ran a completely under the radar procurement program around the world. And the department could see, we would say, if you can get 1 million test kits, then that gives us, 2 months worth or 3 months worth of coverage. And that means that we'll be able to identify as many cases as possible. And that can literally make the difference between what we're seeing in the UK or seeing in Italy, where they were having to triage and determine who would get ventilation and who would die, and Australia getting through it. And so the department was well-led and motivated. But by defining it, and I would often ring relatively junior people in the department out of the blue with questions for them, somebody in the masks or gloves or gowns procurement section, but also to thank them and then to ask them to thank all of their people. And so although we worked with the executive, I found it incredibly important for my team, my private office, which was beautifully led by Joanne Tester and Wendy Black, my co-chiefs of staff, and myself, to be talking with junior people in the department. And to do the same with states, to do the same with all of the medical leadership groups, that personal contact and just the simple thanks meant that, at that time, with an unprecedented level of authority and prominence, it's like, wow, they're engaging with me and they value what I'm doing.
Greg, that's what we would call felt leadership. And you've captured that beautifully. In my own team, I see just how powerful that is, and how the culture can in the team, in the organization, can lift to a new level of quality and performance of whatever it is that we're trying to achieve by doing that. It's so important. I think, or I'm going to guess, it's also extremely important for a public leader to be felt by the individuals in the community. There must have been a lot of hurting, distressed, and confused people out there.
Yeah.
And the temptation could be for the minister to be safely at home in effectively the cabinet office or the ministerial office. To what extent were you able to touch individuals and understand where was the pain, where were they hurting?
Yes, I remember with the early lockdowns, we were obsessive about adhering to the rules, the members of government, PM and Treasurer and myself, and there were many ministers that fell around the world, simply off the back of the breach of rules. But you would nevertheless, if I were working out of my electorate office in Somerville on the Mornington Peninsula in Victoria, because we would do a lot of television interviews from there. I would deliberately go myself by myself out into the community, you know, mask on, get the coffee or the morning granola or whatever it was, and just talk with people. I remember the fog, literal physical fog, a cold morning. People were terrified and just that fear, and so picking that up from the streets just says you've got to give that sense of hope. In the same way at the estuary, you could see it in people's eyes, and you've got to understand. And I remember that a phrase that I used about the restrictions, you know, in the midst of the early lockdowns in the late March 2020, was, you know, these restrictions are so contrary to our nature as Australians, but they are so fundamental to our future. And the goal there was to show that you understand that this is really hard, unimaginable, and particularly if you're a single mum in a flat with, you know, two small children, you know, how hard that could be, but at the same time, how important it is. And so that what we wanted to do was, at a time which in some ways was disempowering for individuals, to actually empower them to say that they, that each individual could save a life or risk a life, and to empower the individuals as well as those involved in the pandemic process.
Greg, thank you. And, I think as thousands of people around the world tune into this podcast, having experienced COVID globally from their point of view, to hear the point of view of a senior leader in Australia and to hear your story and your leadership story and your messages around leadership, I think is wonderful. So a dual question to finish, if I may. You know, what was the key learning for you about leadership, and what advice would you give to our leaders when they're looking for that gem, that takeaway on those critical aspects of good leadership?
Sure. Look, the first one is, for me, and there are numerous theories of leadership, and most of them have important gems, but my theory is it comes down to three things, and anybody's style can vary. And it's pretty simple. It's what, how, and why. And the what is the outcome. Think of it as, say, flattening the curve in order to make sure every person who is ill gets the treatment they need. The second part is the how. And the how was the strategy and explaining it and explaining what we were doing and what we would be doing, and that we were well prepared, but we're not immune. And so, you know, running through those four pillars of containment and four pillars of capacity so people would see what we're doing, but then that actually became the operating framework for what we actually did. And then the final part was the why. And the why was the most important, of saving lives and protecting lives and saving livelihoods. You know, literally that underpinned the economic drivers that the Treasurer, Josh, and the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, put in place. And so that's my very simple explanation of how we approached it and how I approached it. The humanity side and the messaging side, they're all different for different people. But what works for me is to not to pretend you've lived other people's experiences, but to understand their hardship and to recognize that everybody wants to contribute and everybody wants to be empowered. And if you can assist that, with knowledge and then what they can do individually, then that's quite uplifting and empowering.
Greg Hunt, this has been a great conversation. Daryl and I, and I'm sure our listeners as well, are grateful to you for your insights, your thoughts, and your honesty on this tough issue of leadership through disruption. Thank you for joining us.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and thanks to both of you and to Prue for all of your work. And Russell, before all of this, we laid the foundations together for the Australian Space Agency, and that will make a massive difference to the future in the long term. And it was your vision, and I was pleased to join you with some of the right support at the right time. And that's another very exciting future. So at the end of the day, I remain fundamentally optimistic about the world, realistic about the challenges, but optimistic that the natural progression of humanity is overarchingly a positive one.
Thank you, Greg. Enjoy the rest of your time, your day. We really appreciate your time today. Thank you.